My name is Harriet Tramer, and thanks for joining me when I host Reaching for the Gold. I hope you will tune in every other Tuesday at this time when this program is broadcast. My first guest today is Eddie Crothers. He has a real talent for guiding good horses who have gone bad towards more positive futures. Well, my second guest, Dr. Michael Rosen, has developed a real age survey that directs people towards lifestyle changes that can make their existence longer and healthier. So in a very real sense, they both treat the passage of time as being an opportunity to become better, not older. That is a very positive message. Eddie, welcome to the show. You are known for your ability to deal with good horses gone bad. What do you mean by that? How could a horse go bad? What do you mean by a good horse?
Well, I've been breaking bad horses for approximately 35 years, and usually we look at a bad horse is mainly a dissonant problem. The horse does not want to behave or do what we're asking the horse to do. Over the years, I have came up with technique that pretty much I'm finding out that these horses that we are saying, you know, are very disrespectful, I am finding out these are horses that are actually in pain. Veterinarian pain, you know, veterinarians, chiropractors, they have knee hocks, you know, their backs out, their hips out, their necks out. And these are problems that these horses are having that are not real visual on, you know, where you're able to look and say, hey, you know, his neck's out, or, you know, he's having these pain issues. And so they kind of start out with one pain, off of that pain, and then they have a numerous of pain. And I have started to figure out that 90% of disrespect is pain.
Give me an example of, you said,
well,
you figured it out. Give me an example,
yeah,
of how you came to that conclusion.
Well, you know, the thing of it is, I've had a lot of horses, and I got a few cases just came in here recently. But, you know, I look at a horse that's broke, that's trained. These are horses that once they're trained, I think they should be trained for life. And I have horses that come in. I got, for one example, I've got a beautiful quarter horse that a lady had bought, and, you know, she paid around $4,500 for this horse. Gets it home, puts a saddle on, horse act very nervous. And this is a story that a lot of people can tell you is, I go ride the horse, I buy the horse, it goes home, and it throws me off. This is a horse that went home, wasn't acting right, and this client of mine called me up and says, hey, Ed, I bought this new horse. I'd love to bring it to your house and you can see what's wrong and make sure it's safe for me to ride. So they brought the horse to the farm, so they put the saddle on the horse. They went running backwards and flipped over backwards. every time I put the saddle on, the horse would flip over. And, you know, years and years ago, that was a pretty serious problem on, you know, getting the rider hurt. And it's a problem that we keep trying different techniques, different things, on trying to get this animal to quit flipping over. They, you know, also call these horses that are girthy. You tighten the saddle up and they just explode, and then sometimes you can go ahead and ride them. But I ended up checking. This horse was out in the pole. She was out two places on the left side of her neck, and she had a hock that was bothering her, and she had a really, really bad ulcer. And this was a horse that if you watched it, you would have said, this horse is just an idiot. You know, he needs to either put down or send down the road and make somebody else be somebody else's problems. Once we cleaned the pain issues up, put this horse on ulcer medicine, got his stomach feeling better, 10 days later, the most trained horse I ever rode in my life.
Really?
This horse will sit down, slide, walk, jog, and canter with his head down. He will back. He will go trail riding. This horse will side pass. Any place you push a button, he will respond. So the trainer did a wonderful job on doing what he did with the horse unfortunately, the pain issues came involved, and then the horse wasn't able to, you know, show you what his capabilities were.
Now, so, you're not a veterinarian.
Pardon me?
You're not a veterinarian.
No, not a veterinarian. I do a lot of clinics. I'm actually an equine analyst on the standpoint. I've been doing this so long that I get in a round pen, you know, with a horse at my clinics that they're having trouble with. And just from the, you know, I probably broke just at my farm over 3,000 head in the last 12 years.
3,000?
Yes. And so I go in there and I actually show people on, I ask the horse turn to the right. Well, he can't turn to the right, he can turn to the left. So if an animal has a certain direction that he has trouble with, a lot of times we mistake that as he's a right-hand, left-hand horse. But when I start doing other things and asking this animal to do other stuff on the ground, and you start realizing, hey, if you do this, it hurts, but he'll do that because it don't hurt. So I start breaking it down and then going over the animal and palpating and showing people exactly where the animal hurts. I mean, horses' body language, if we look at them as a deal of you might have some pain issues, in a sort of way, they are telling us, but we take it and mistake it as a horse being disrespectful.
Now, have you been around horses your entire life, or how did you come to this?
I've been my whole life here since I was a kid. I mean, when the teachers would ask the kids to stand up and say what they want to be when they grow up, I was the guy or the kid that said, I want to be a trainer, and I want to be able to train and get horses to do things that nobody else can get them to do. I was probably 12 years old.
And how did the teacher react to that?
When she decided that was might not have been one of the best professions to go into, actually, you know, the teacher and, you know, had several times had talked to me on, you know, you need to be something else, or you need to go to college and be this, and you need to go to college and be that. So, you know, growing up, you know, years ago, that was probably not one of the main professions that, you know, a kid should be going out trying to do.
Now,
and it was
I'm going to take some of what you're saying and extend it a little farther. What have you learned in dealing with horses that also apply to people? In other words, you talk about understanding body language. Do you do that also with people?
Yeah. I mean, actually, you know, animals and horses especially, that's what I deal with on an everyday basis. Their whole structure of everything they do, it's all about body language. They're always telling you something. They're always telling you, I don't want to do it, or they're telling you, I don't understand. And most of the time, horses are telling us, I don't understand. And I'm able to read the body language and help them understand. And it's like two people speaking two different languages and trying to communicate. Until we bring another person in that speaks both languages, these two people have no way of communicating until we bring the third person in that's able to hook the two different languages up and get communication started.
Now, obviously horses do not have our refined intellect, the human brain, but they do have a very keen sense of balance. Is that what you're touching on when you talk about their body language?
Well, it's a communication, and sort of, yes, but also it's the structure of their eyes, their face, and it's almost like sign language. Horses will look and use body language to try to get across on what direction they don't understand or they don't want to do, or the biggest thing is hurt. Hurting is one of the main things that we seem to have trouble understanding and we mistake it as disrespect, and the horse just doesn't want to work today. He just, you know, he's out here bucking and, you know, trying to kill us just because he doesn't want to do our half hour or 2 hours of work. And it's easy to mistake it for, I just don't want to work.
All right, if I'm riding a horse and it's being very disrespectful, polite way of saying it's trying to run off with me, whatever, what body language is there that would tell me, okay, this animal is not being disrespectful, it's in pain? How do I know that? Isn't that a great leap of faith?
Yeah, I mean, it's and that's one of the main things that a lot of us riding horses mistakes on the idea that this horse wants to run off to get rid of me, wants to run off because he doesn't want to work. But the biggest thing is, most of the time, it's pain. It's hurting, okay? Chances are it's hurting in the back end. You know, horses has get away from pain, just like they get away from pressure. We train horses all on the release of pressure. You put pressure on, the horse moves, we release. So the horse learns that that pressure, and I do what I'm asked to do, I get immediately released. So I have learned that pressure, I move, I get released, I understand. Unfortunately, we put the saddle on, we get on. Sometimes a horse can get spooked and take off. Most of the time, your runoff is all because of pain. A horse gets spooked, he'll take off, but he'll stop because the incident is over now. But a horse that's in pain and he's hurting in the back end, it's almost like somebody just hitting with an electric fence. And all he's trying to do is get away of the pain, which is pretty similar to pressure, but it hurts. It's different than pressure on the aspect of it actually hurts. So they're running from it. They're actually running from the pain, which at this case, you're on his back and you're actually going for the run as well. And it gets mistaken. A lot of times horses run off and run into stuff. And most of the time, they're running from pain. I've had horses that were runoffs brought to the farm. I analyze them. We get them fixed. And I have got on the horse and ask it to do a few things. And the horse bolts off and takes off in a dead run. Okay, I get the animal stopped. We fix his problem 2 days later. I couldn't make him run if I held a gun to his head. You know, horses does not want to work any harder than they have to, and they're pretty similar to us. I mean, we're not going to go around, you know, 300 feet when we can go straight across 100 feet and get to the same place that we're going. And if a horse is running off, he's using a whole lot more energy than he needs to. And, you know, horses are not going to work any harder than they have to unless they have pain driving them, you know, into these incidents and, you know, these bad behavior and getting people hurt. I mean, every horse, I mean, I probably have, in a year's time, might be 100 to even three, between 100 to 300 horses. People will call me, I have no clue who they are bringing me horses for me to go over to look and see why they broke the guy's leg or their daughter's arm or their backs, or, you know, all of a sudden I get a call, you know, this horse has broke my son's back, and they say, bring it to you. And when I go over the animal and break it down and show the 7 to 8 places that is hurting, then the people start understanding what he did wasn't on purpose. He had pain issues that he was just getting away from the pain, and then, you know, that's how the person got hurt, because they were in the middle of the horse trying to get away from the pain.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sure you do a fantastic job, but if I'm riding and the animal is being disobedient, I'm feeling danger, if you're not around, what can I do? Take him to a veterinarian and say, I think he's in pain, that he's acting this way? What can I do?
Well, the biggest thing is, just let's go a little further than that. Say you're on a horse, okay, you rode him yesterday, didn't act right. Okay, so you figured maybe he's just in a bad mood or whatever. Today, you get on your animal again, and he's worse. You know, I'm a firm believer, when your animal is not acting right, number one, get off. Most of the time, horses that's getting ready to do something bad, they usually give you some warning. And to get off, and to, you know, and a lot of times what we do is, okay, I'm not a good enough rider, so I'm going to call, you know, a friend down the road. He's a good rider, and I'm going to have him come and ride this horse. Maybe he can straighten him up. Or I'm going to send him to a trainer. A lot of times that's what they do. They call me up and says, Eddie, you got a horse we can't do anything with. And they start telling me the things that the horse is doing, the behaviors, which I have figured it out on the numerous of bad horses, that I can almost tell that person exactly where the pain issues are just because of what he's doing to the people, trying to get away from his pain. Now, these horses go to the trainers, and if they're in pain, all they do is start riding around the pain. We have not fixed a problem. Your horse goes back home. The person gets back on. The horse is the same way. You know, the same way he was when he left, and we just say the trainer didn't do his job, and that's not the case. You know, when your horse starts acting up, first thing is, one, get off. And to start sitting down and figure out what did he do or what caused him to act up. Was he pulling to the right? Was he pulling to the left? Was he pulling back hard? Was you doing something that agitated him to get, you know, to change his manners? And then try to figure out on the ground what's agitating him. Then is to call your veterinarian, but you have to be able to explain to your vet enough so he knows what to go look for on why did your animal get mad. You know, if you just say he's acting like a brat, I call the vet, he comes out, and the vet looks at him, oh, I don't see anything wrong with him. Well, when you start figuring out what you did, well, I turned him to the right, or I backed him up, or I did this, or whatever, then you can explain to your veterinarian or chiropractor, you know, when I do this, he just gets upset. Well, they start looking at those areas and start realizing that this animal has some pain issues or have some problems. And a lot of these horses, it's hard to find the pain unless they're actually limping or they're actually holding their head down and can't move it. But these animals are having pain, and they still can function to the point, if you're not looking for it or paying attention, you don't realize it. And the first thing you say is, he knows that I don't have the ability to make him work. So, you know, and everybody, I mean, in the last few years, I've probably looked over 1,000 head. I have not once found a horse that came here that was disrespectful or that was here because he didn't want to work because he was disrespectful. A disrespectful horse will not put the effort in on to be bad. And what I'm saying is, a disrespectful horse is a horse that's kind of lazy. He don't want to work today. But he ain't going to buck wild. He ain't going to flip over backwards. He ain't going to run off. He's trying to get out of work, so he's not going to make work. Every one of these horses that are doing the exotic stuff, they're in pain. They're just in pain because horses don't want to work that hard.
Let's take what you say is very interesting, but let's take and apply it to people. Now, you hear all these ideas that as people get older, they're cantankerous. They won't listen to anybody. Could that be because they're in pain? In other words, can you apply what you're saying to horses, to people, that we're not listening to the fact they may be in pain?
Yes. It's the same thing. It's pain that sometimes, you know, people learn to try to live with it. A lot of people, you know, that all of a sudden their back's hurting, you know, and they're complaining about their back, which they haven't, but now their back is really hurting bad, and they're complaining. Okay, well, they already have a bad knee that has been, you know, it's been hurting them for so long, they don't even talk about it no more. Or they have a foot or have other pain issues that they have learned to live with because maybe there's no way of making them disappear. And then we add a new pain on top of their old pain. And so you have a person that, you know, anything that just gets out of their normal day becomes a big aggravation and a very hard to understand that us as people, you know, same thing with the horses, we just don't pay attention of why this person isn't the person they always are. And pain is a big issue.
And might
we
have
all
become,
have pain.
Might it become more and more of an issue as people get older?
Yes. And we all have pain. We have pain that we're able to deal with. And sometimes we just go on and cover it up and go on. And then we have days that a new pain pops up. And we mentally and physically can't handle with our attitude because that was the icing on top of the cake. And then this person's irritable, you know, lashing out of little stuff that normally they could handle. And then takes people in different directions.
Now, with contact sports like football, your series or your career in the NFL generally is, what, like about 5 years?
Yep, 5 years.
Your body can only take so much. With riding, is the aging, not only of the horse, but of the human who rides, a very different thing? In other words, can you be riding till you're 70, 80, doing pretty much the same thing you did when you were 20?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, I know a lot of people that actually still riding horses today that is 60 to 70 years old. But the older you get, sometimes, you know, pain issues is reasons why you can't do the things you did when you were 20.
Now, how has your work with these horses changed the way you look at aging? In other words, you said you've been doing it for how many years?
I've been doing it for about 35 years.
Okay.
And I do it between 8 to 14 hours a day, 6 days a week.
14 hours a day?
Day, yeah. So at least, you know, 6 days a week, 8 to 14 hours, I have a horse in front of me, a different horse, you know, that I'm either riding, I'm working, somebody's bringing. So 8 to 14 hours, or yeah, 8 to 12 hours a day, I have a horse in front of me. A lot of times people have horses that'll bring to me at nighttime that's sick. That's colic and that also. So, you know, I'm pretty much, you know, my whole life is based on a horse standing in front of me that has a problem, or I'm trying to figure out why this animal is not doing what he needs to do.
Now, do you think this experience has changed the way you have aged? Do you think it's kept you young?
Yeah. I mean, you know, when I get in a round pen and figure out a horse that has been misunderstood, and I'm able to break it down and show the person that what this animal did, he had good reasoning from cause of pain, and the hookup. I mean, you know, every day when I'm working with an animal in a round pen, and it's almost, it's like a high to be able to get this connection and this understanding between this animal and knowing how this animal is hurting, and I can see it, and this animal told me and fixed it, and then start seeing this animal follow me around and giving me unbelievable respect of whatever I say, this animal is doing everything in its possible way to please me, and all because of the understanding, and he feels good, and he feels great. And it's just like people in nursing homes that are not unable to communicate. It's the same thing. When nurses, you know, make them feel good and make them happy, and their pain is not there because they understand you've got a headache. You can't tell me you've got a headache, but I can tell by your body language you have a headache. I give you some Tylenol. A few minutes later, the nurse walks by, and this person is smiling every time this person goes by because they just made them feel good, and pain is not there. And that's the same thing I get from the horses.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm trying to teach people, to be able to back up, figure out why your animal is being bad. He's been great for 2 years, he's been great for a year, or he's been great for 5 years. Why does he pick now to say, I don't want to do nothing, and I just bucked you off, you know? So I'm trying to get it across in clinics to teach people to see what I see and to understand what I understand and give these animals some help and be able to go on with a maintenance program on whatever things bothering them and still be a functionable horse and can be used for the mm-hmm. 5 more years now and be safe.
But do you think that has kept you young?
Yes.
If you went to your high school reunion, do you think you'd feel much younger than many of the people you went to school with?
Oh, yes. Yep. I mean, you know, I just turned 50, and, you know, I've been fortunate enough to rode all these bad horses and be, you know, been fortunate enough to be able to still get up in the morning and go do what I love doing.
Mm-hmm. Eddie, if people would like to learn more about you and what you're doing, how can they contact you?
Okay, they can go to my website, which is www.goodhorsegonebad.com. And then they can see also I invented a new horse halter and with buttons on the inside. It's, you know, it doesn't hurt them. And also I invented a halter for cattle that is going all over the United States and also in other countries. And it's a halter that has buttons in there where an average person that's learning about cattle or horses is able to operate the halter by moving the buttons, tells the animal, I call them communication buttons, and tells the animal exactly what that person needs or wants or what direction. So when the animal moves, the halter automatically releases itself because that person doesn't have to say, pressure, okay, I have to release. As soon mm-hmm. as the animal moves, it automatically releases and gives this person that, you know, maybe just starting in the business of either, you know, cattle or horses, makes it a lot easier. The animal starts understanding. The people are able to see that the animal understanding and gets them a very quickly hook up and gets them to learn and understand what the animal is doing.
Mm-hmm. Eddie,
and
thank
is,
you.
Pardon me?
Thank you very much for being on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. I enjoyed it. And, you know, the biggest thing is, and I tell everybody I can, if the other thing is, if you're riding an animal, horse, and you're afraid, you know, the old way is to ride through your fear. No. If a person is afraid, they get on a horse and they're afraid, no matter how small the place they're trying to ride, get off of your animal, move him on the ground, get your body to and heart rate to come back down, and take whatever length of time, 5 to 10 minutes, leading him, doing some groundwork on the ground, get back on your animal, and ask mm-hmm. him to go forward and try to accomplish what your fear is. You know, a lot of people say horses, are they smell that you're afraid. Nah, they don't. They only feel when you're afraid. And when you get scared and you lock up, your communications stop, then your animal loses leadership and then starts trying to find it, and that's when problems happen. So mm-hmm. if you get scared, get off, give yourself 10 minutes, get back on.
Mm-hmm. I would like to remind all my listeners that you can get more information about aging at my website, Harriet Tramer, H-T-R-A-M-E-R.com, H-T-R-A-M-E-R com, and thank you for listening. Dr. Roizen, thank you for being on the show, and good afternoon.
My privilege.
How did you happen to devise the real age test? First off, what is the real age test? What is it measuring?
Well, real age is the actual age of your body as opposed to your calendar age. So your real age can be many years older or younger than your calendar age based on your health habits. And what we did was we took everything in health that affected your length of life or your disability rates and factored those in. It's 15 or 16 years after we first developed it and put it on the web, the first 26 million people, their usage of it and what happened to them in terms of are they alive or not, just mortality rate, was looked at. And in fact, in a published paper that we had nothing to do with, we gave the data to an independent research group from UC San Diego. They looked at it and found that it was more accurate as a prediction of length of life than was Framingham or any or Reynolds or any of the other current systems out there. So, in fact, because we took into account 151 factors that affect your rate of aging. Everything from the level of stress you have and how you manage it to how many servings of fruits and vegetables you eat a day, to whether you floss your teeth, et cetera. So we did all of that, and the totality is what came into being your real age. And so your real age not only tells you what your actual age is, so if you're 52 calendar years of age, you could be 48 or 42, or you could be 67. It also gives you those things in a priority based on largest to smallest, or any way you want to set up the priority. You get to change it on the website. It's a free website at realage.com. So you get to change it and set up what priority you want, pick two or three things that you want to do to get younger, and then as you do those, you can adjust or put down that you're doing them, and that will adjust your real age to let you know what you're doing to your rate of aging.
It's fascinating to me that this should turn out to be such a terribly accurate predictor. It's fascinating because when you study anything about researching and methodology, one thing you're told is people are not very good reporters of their life. In other words, you ask them how tall they are. Well, every man is 6 foot. You ask the women how much they weigh. Well, they all weigh 110 pounds. What about this test? I believe you. It's just fascinating to me to try to figure this out.
They're not reporting it to anyone but themselves. In other words, if they lie on it, it's just for themselves that they're lying on it. It's not that we give this to anyone. It's a test for yourself. So it is solely for you, and I guess people are more accurate when they're doing it for themselves.
In other words, if I go to the auto bureau and I get my driver's license, I may weigh 120, but I'm not going to want to sit there and look at somebody and say I weigh 120, so I'd tell them I weigh 115. If I'm just doing it for myself, I might put down 120.
I don't know whether that's the true or the... I mean, that, it seems very logical. I don't know what the reason is, but... whether it is just it's more accurate than all the others, but it's really awfully darn accurate. So using what we did is there are 151 factors when you look at the data in the literature that there are more than four studies on which you can do what we call either Kaplan-Meier survival or disability curves. That is, calculate the aging effect of changing that habit. And it had to be in at least four studies. So it's not one study that this reflects, but a series of studies. and it's not, you know, and so maybe that's why it's so accurate. But irrespective of it being that accurate or not, what the key is that it lets you know what things are important and have been found important in repeated studies in the literature. So it's a trusted source, if you will, for knowing those things that we know affect aging. So, for example, we know to a large degree that supplements of vitamin E don't affect it. On the other hand, we know that supplements of vitamin D do affect it. So you find that those choices, if you will, in the literature.
Now,
and integrated into the program.
You mentioned something, and it's a very, very apparent word about changing behavior. Maybe I don't understand, but from everything I've read or heard, it's difficult to get people to change their behavior. It's not everyone who loses, I'm just going to say, 25 pounds and keeps it off. What clues, if I take this test and it indicates I need to change my behavior in area A, B, C, and D, what clues can you give me that will actually lead to my changing my behavior?
Well, the reason that people tend to do the test is because they want to find out where they are, whether they change and how much they change. And so what really affects them is, are they doing things that affect their rate of aging or their rate of disability? And if they are, then a certain percentage of them will change those. In fact, I can tell you almost exactly that no one will change whether they wear a seatbelt or not. You know, when we've had people, of the choices that people make to change behavior over time, virtually no one changes whether they're wearing a seatbelt or not. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people will change how much they walk or what type of exercise they do, or how many fruits and vegetables, or whether they eat a lot of red meat. And so we see, and this is all voluntary and inserted themselves, excuse me, we see a lot of changes that are made. And in other words, what is the motivation? Well, for about a third of people, it is your rate of aging or their rate of aging and how much they can change it. So age, not whether they're going to live to be 150 or whether they're going to die 20 years from now, because if it's more than 20 years in the future, people discount that so it doesn't have an effect on them. So how long you're going to live doesn't matter as much as the energy you live with now. And that's why it's called real age. It's the actual age you are now and how much you can change your current age that we found motivated a good third of the people who take the test. So two-thirds don't change. Two-thirds find out their age, might come back a few times, but don't change very much, whereas one-third of the people who take the test repeatedly will change significantly and will make a behavior change.
Now, possibly, this is not a yes or no matter, it's complicated but interesting. Our society, you talk about people changing. Our society is changing in terms of the way it looks at health. In other words, how many people were vegetarians 15 years ago, or if not strict vegetarians, limited the amount of red meat they eat, and how many are now? How many took yoga 15 years ago, and how many are taking yoga now? So it may not just be a matter of people changing. It may be a whole society waking up in important ways.
I think you're right in that we as a society have made some cultural changes which are important. So we have decreased the amount of cigarettes we smoke and decreased the amount in public. considerably. Over the last 7 years, from the two Nihane studies, we've increased the number of fruit and vegetables we've eaten and decreased the red meat and saturated fat. We are not managing stress as well, which is contradicting that. And believe it or not, we've done about 1% more physical activity a year since 1996 as a nation, 1% per year. So I think there are a number of changes which have made a sizable benefit, as you pointed out, from a, if you will, societal or cultural standpoint that have promise. But there are a number that have haven't done it, meaning there are a number of opposing views, meaning opposing things we haven't done. One that we're beginning to see now is management of stress, but at least our data would say, and other data, not just ours, but our data would say people are feeling a huge amount more stress than they did in 1979 to 1990 to 1983, which is where that we have the original data from.
Now, okay, we're going to go through this step by step because it's very important. If I am feeling stress, my job, my home life, whatever it is, if I am feeling stress, what are some clues you could give me to help manage that stress?
Well, one, you have to, and there's a very simple perceived stress scale that's a 10-question test that you can do online. You can do it at clevelandclinicwellness.com or clevelandclinic.org/wellness. Easy one, clevelandclinicwellness.com, and go to the stress-free now, and there's a area called the PSS, the Perceived Stress Scale, which is a national scale that's been validated, and it's only 10 questions, and you can find out how stressed you are, if you will. Obviously, the event isn't what is stressful. It's your response to it. And so there are a whole group of things you can do to manage that response. So the program, Stress-Free Now, and there is a charge for it, but to do the initial test, is the scale, is free. But the program teaches you over a six-week period where you would put in an hour a week for 6 weeks, eight different techniques to manage stress. And there are free versions of this for each of the techniques on other websites, you can learn them. So whether it's progressive muscle relaxation, tightening up all the muscles in your body and then progressively relaxing them, or breathing where you focus on your belly button going in and out, you're breathing in and out. And some people say it's clearing the mind. I say it's focusing the mind on one thing. Or you have a mantra you say. Or you do guided imagery. Or you do some other form of meditation. Well, there are eight techniques. And it turns out that people who take the Stress-Free Now program will grab one technique after they've learned some places, so they skip around and might learn three techniques, and they'll grab one that works for them. So there always are techniques. One of the interesting things is no group of more than 30% of people will grab one technique. That's the 30% rule. But if you show them eight techniques, you can get almost everyone to do one of the techniques that helps them manage their response to events.
Now, this is just my perception, but I think it's a pretty widely held perception. If we as a culture are becoming more health conscious, we are also becoming more stressful. Things are just not as secure as they were. You said 76 you began this?
No, the perceived stress scale was developed between 1979 and 83.
Okay.
We started the Real Age program, which includes the analysis of this to take into account how many events you have, your response to it, and how much it ages you or doesn't. That was launched publicly in 99. We started the research on it in 93.
Mm-hmm. 93, 99. If you look back then, at least as I perceive it and others perceive it, we have a much more stressful society than we had then.
Well, I don't know whether the society is more stressful. I tend to believe you because we don't have data on that.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, deaths are stressful. It's not just how much you're sued. It's not just the event. It is your response to it. And clearly, our response to stressful events compared to when the scale was developed in 1983... In America, it's a minus 10 to plus 30 scale. And in America, men were 12.1 and women were 13.7 on average in 1983. We're now both running around 23, much higher than we did in the earlier era. So that's correct. The level of stress we have, the level of stress we perceive now from our life is a level that... it's a level that would cause chronic disease in 19 was associated with causing chronic disease in 1983.
A lot of what you say, at least I find empowering. You talk about perceived stress or reaction to events. When you speak in those terms, you present people as being very much in control of how they will be affected by what happens around them. That's a very powerful statement.
Yeah, that's the data. So people, you know, our genetics control about 30% of how long and how well we live, but our choices control 70%. But the older we are, the greater our choices affect it, and the less the genes we were born with affect it. So you get a do-over, and it is the do-over is because you get to choose different things. You get to manage your response to stress or not. So you really do have the power.
In other words, if I'm just going to say 65. I have more power in how I manage my stress than might a child?
No. The child and you have just as much power in managing the stress. But whether that stress affects your genetic and your longevity, you have more power over. It's a subtle difference, meaning when you're younger, a gene that penetrates, that is expressed, is a much more significant thing than when you're older and you get to control those genes to a much greater degree. So the power you have on blocking the stress response is the same. The power you have at change at turning on and off your genes is greater.
Really? In other words, if I'm 64, I have a greater potential to turn off certain genes that...
Or turn on, right.
Or turn on.
Well, it is that that those genes that penetrate before the age of 25 tend to be much more significant.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's a very difficult concept to express in a non-scientific way, so I apologize. But essentially, the older you are, the more your choices affect how long and how well you live compared to the choices when you were under 20.
In other words, if I'm 65, I have more of a choice if I live to 85 in good health than I do when I'm 25, looking very far forward.
No. And forgive me. I think it is too tough to explain in a short period of time, but I'm not obviously explaining it well because I'm not getting it across. But basically, whether you live without disability and disease for the next 10 years is much easier to do at 55 than it is at 15.
I can have more of a control on these matters.
You have more control. That's correct.
Not so hard to understand. And actually, what you were saying gives a very different view of aging than a lot of people have. Some people seem to believe the older I get, the more I'm enfeebled, I can't control things. What you're saying is the exact opposite.
I don't know what you're saying is probably correct. I am saying the opposite of what many people think.
And has this affected the way you personally, I mean, we're all aging. Has this affected personally the way you view your aging?
Well, it doesn't view how I view aging, but it does view and it change the choices I make. Unfortunately, allergies have gotten me in a post-nasal drip today. We had one warm day in Cleveland, and obviously everything is flowering at the same time, and I'm unfortunately have some seasonal allergies which have knocked me into a post-nasal drip today, so I apologize for coughing occasionally. But what I am saying is in other words, I thought in 1992 that I was doing all the things correctly for aging. When we started studying it, we got a group of five of us together, and three people who spent full time on this, and two others of us who spent 20 or so hours a week on it. When we looked at the data, and when I looked at the data on choices and which choices to make were much stronger and much more evident. So in 1999 or 1997 or 1994, the data on avoiding more than 4 ounces of red meat in a week was very clear, very definitive, and very solid. And so it was in the program when we launched it publicly in late 98, and when we published the initial books on real age in 99. Now it's gotten accepted regularly, routinely now, but in fact the data, and we know much more about why it's so bad for you, but in fact I changed from eating red meat to going off of red meat, including pork, in some place in the 93 or 94. So it wasn't that I wasn't trying to eat healthier. My concept of that we had a lot of power based on the data before that. But what was different was how solid the choices were and how big an effect they had. So if you're saying, of the 151 things, I do about 149 of them consistently. One of them I don't do because it pertains only to women. And one of them I don't do because I'm lousy at, I enjoy life enough that I spend less time sleeping than I should.
But you do the other things and you have an increasingly stronger feeling that, yes, this is going to benefit you.
Correct.
It's very interesting. Very interesting. Now, do you think most people who do this real age survey, which I understand is in the millions, do you think they understand why these things will benefit them, or is it insignificant if they understand that one way or another, they just have to know it will benefit them?
Well, human beings tend to do things more when they understand the rationale than just do this. On the other hand, what you find in medicine, because we've been, quote, subservient to our physicians in both knowledge and in actions, our physician gives us a pill and expects us to take it perfectly. It's obviously only 60% of us will fill any prescription, even when it's free, and only about 30% of us take that prescription at the end of the year. Clearly, if we explained things better and motivated better, we would get higher success rate at our patients taking the medications we think are appropriate for them. So I think explanations are important, even if it's just so that they're confident that you know what you're talking about from a physician or website standpoint. And so at Real Age, we have a lot of the explanations as well as videos explaining things in a graphic format, since Dr. Oz and I do a lot of those, and he is a great video explainer. But in fact, a lot of people, once they look at one or two explanations, will then go and do many of the other things without looking at the full explanation. They just want to have some confidence that it's there.
In other words, okay, I had this explained to me, so I know why this has to be done. That person knows what they're talking about. I should listen to them when they say other things.
Correct.
All right, Dr. Rosen, thank you very, very much for being a guest. And why don't you tell our listeners again where they can get the information you've discussed?
The information I've discussed, all of the Real Age tests, and it's a free test, is at realage.com, R-E-A-L-A-G-E.com, one word, .com, and you not only find out your actual age and how fast your body's aging, but you can find out all those things that can make you younger or all those things that are making you older. For more information on the programs that can help you if you want, for example, for stress like you asked about, you can go to ClevelandClinicWellness.com, ClevelandClinicWellness.com, one word, ClevelandClinicWellness, put it all together, .com. Thank you for the opportunity of talking with you.